Good evening. Massive explosions at a port in Lebanon kills at least 60, injuring hundreds. A tropical storm threatens New York with tornadoes, and Trump reverses himself on mail-in voting when it affects the GOP. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, August 4th, 2020. At least two massive explosions shook Beirut on Tuesday, injuring and killing hundreds of people, strewing devastation across multiple neighborhoods and shattering windows for miles around. At least one hospital reports 400 injuries, including several members of the government. The head of Lebanon's security forces said a warehouse near the explosion was being used to store high explosives seized by the government several years ago. The prime minister of Lebanon, Hassan Diab, called it a dangerous depot and said more information will be announced later. Meanwhile, in Congress, both parties are claiming a deal is in the works as millions of Americans wonder if they'll lose their unemployment insurance while facing eviction. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
We spent the lunch with Secretary Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows discussing their discussions with the Speaker and the Democratic leader, which will resume this afternoon. I think they have said that there's not a whole lot of movement yet, but a feeling that seems to have been expressed that we'd like to get an outcome. I certainly hope we can. The coronavirus is certainly not over. It's still an enormous problem. It's still affecting communities all across the country. And I think the American people would like to see us working together and getting an outcome like we did back in March and April.
Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Republicans are in disarray but coming around. The Democrat-controlled House has already passed the $3 trillion HEROES Act that continues $600 a week unemployment insurance payments and provided hundreds of billions in aid to cities dealing from the coronavirus.
This is the greatest crisis affecting America in 75 years economically and 100 years health-wise. We believe it needs a big, bold response. A skiddy bill that just touches on one or two of the many problems. A bill that says if we have a million starving kids who aren't getting fed, we should compromise and feed half of them. That doesn't work. And yet the Republicans are so tied up, so many of them, in their ideological knot that they don't want to spend money. The negotiations are moving forward bit by bit. We are moving closer together on certain issues. There are many more to go. The bottom line is very simple. We need real help. I am hopeful. Why, you say? Because in the last three negotiations, Republicans first said, no, we're doing the minimum. We said, no, we have to do more, and they came in our direction. Leader McConnell just said that he's not going to get a whole lot of Republican votes for whatever is going to pass. So I'd remind the Republican leader and the negotiators that if this bill is going to pass with all Democrats in the House and a majority of Democrats in the Senate, it's got to be something that Democrats like and support.
And that's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on the Constitution, chaired by Texas Republican Ted Cruz, was holding hearings billed as protecting free speech and preventing violent protests. One of the witnesses is a prosecutor from Texas, Erin Neely Cox, who also sits on Attorney General William Barr's newly created advisory committee. Neely Cox explains her target is anti-government violence, not white supremacist attacks on ordinary people.
Regardless of their name or their radical ideology, if they're violent and they're anti-government, we're going to be looking at them. If it's just a white supremacist that's engaging in gang activity or drug activity, like the types of gangs that we prosecuted in the Northern District of Texas, that would not fall under the purview of our task force.
What was that? What would not fall within the purview of your task force?
If it's white supremacy groups that are not engaging in anti-government violence, such as the kinds
they may not be engaging in anti-government violence, but they're engaging in all kinds of other violence, such as running over people. Does that not concern you?
I have no objection to your characterization as white supremacy groups engaging in violence. We prosecuted those in my district. Mm-hmm. The only point that I'm making, Senator, is we're limiting the purview of the task force to violent anti-government groups, whether they are motivated by race or whether they are just anti-authority, anti-law enforcement.
I think that is a real concern, because one can consider anti-government extremists to be protesters. For example, I would say during the Vietnam War, the thousands and thousands, if not millions of protesters, were deemed anti-government protesters. So I think that's a dangerous way to think about it. Mr. Cuccinelli, you described that what your organization did in Portland was following standard law enforcement procedures. So I take it that you would not be concerned when the IG of the DHS IG looks at the appropriateness of what happened to Christopher Davis, who was beaten by a baton and having pepper spray sprayed into his face while he was standing there. And nor would you be terribly concerned at what happened to Donovan Labdilla, who was shot in the head and had to have surgery. I would think that the IG would look into those kinds of force by people at DHS. You would not be concerned, because this is all standard police, standard law enforcement practice?
We're certainly concerned with anyone at any of these events. Both of the two that you identified are being addressed by the DOJ Inspector General. Those do not involve DHS officers.
So you would have concern if DOJ officers were doing those kinds of things, pretty much unprovoked violence against peaceful protesters. You would have a concern. That's good to know. Last week, the ACLU submitted court declarations from multiple journalists. Oh, this is for you, Mr. Cuccinelli, who swore under oath that federal agents in Portland specifically attacked them, even though they were unmistakably marked as press. One journalist described federal agents shooting him in the chest and aiming a tear gas canister at his head while he filmed the agents using force against a dancing protester. Another press videographer explained he had covered conflict zones around the world, including ISIS in northern Syria, and never had weapons aimed or discharged at him, as he did by federal agents in Portland. Have you clearly instructed DHS that they must not target or use force against journalists?
And that was Hawaii Democrat Macy Huron, who was questioning Ken Cuccinelli, the acting head of Homeland Security. And prior to that, she was speaking with Erin Neely Cox, who sits on Attorney General William Barr's newly created advisory committee. Committee Chair Ted Cruz began his statement expressing sadness for the killing of George Floyd, but he soon diverged, claiming Antifa and other leftists were the real problem.
But what began as legitimate protests against a vile act of abuse, sadly, were soon hijacked by opportunists and violent radicals. By early June, rioters had injured more than 700 law enforcement officers in Philadelphia. Police cars were set ablaze. In Seattle, rioters who damaged hundreds of buildings were granted and allowed to set up a so-called autonomous zone by local officials. Their actions are profoundly racist, the rioters, as they destroy minority communities, minority businesses, and minority lives across this country. No one has a right to assault another person, to firebomb a building, to throw a Molotov cocktail into a police car. It is coordinated and inspired by leftist anarchist groups, groups like Antifa, that will, without shame, exploit a national tragedy to attack American buildings, American homes, and American lives. But for good measure, in graffiti on the county courthouse, they wrote, "Until the police and ICE are abolished, we will burn this city down piece by piece."
And that's Committee Chair Republican Ted Cruz Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden countered that a study of people arrested during protests in Portland showed the vast majority were not extremists.
Mr. Chairman, the Associated Press did an analysis of 200 Portland arrests, and they found that most who were charged for nonviolent acts did not fit the depiction of an anarchist. Why make these baseless conspiratorial accusations and send in secret police? Donald Trump sent in the secret police to create images of chaos for political gain, to air in campaign ads and provide a basis for bad faith discussions. Fortunately, in the days since federal forces backed off, the chaos has largely stopped in Portland. But the president is still getting the scenes of violence for the ads that he wanted, and he threatens further escalation in Portland and elsewhere. Now, this nonsense about leftist anarchy also papers over the murders and vandalism committed by far-right domestic terrorists. Those murders have been on the rise. Far-right criminals have been caught committing acts of vandalism at the scenes of Black Lives Matter protests. This baseless talk about leftist anarchy also erases the work done by all those who stood up in peaceful protest to declare that Black Lives Matter. In the wake of the murder of George Floyd, millions and millions of Americans, all ages, all ethnicities, all backgrounds, participated in protests calling for an end to inequality and violence against Black Americans. All of this talk about leftist anarchy is just a big deflection from the nationwide call for justice.
And that's Ron Wyden. He's the Democratic senior senator from Oregon. South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham hit back that protesters in Portland had been determined to burn down a federal courthouse.
If we had done nothing, what would have happened to the courthouse, Mr. Cuccinelli, in Portland?
That courthouse wouldn't be there in any function.
So I challenge anybody on the other side to say different. If we hadn't intervened, they'd burn the goddamn thing down. Seattle. Were you in Seattle, or either one of you in Seattle, when they took over part of the town? Did we send anybody in there to help?
We were not requested, and there was no federal...
Well, they worked it out in Seattle after they took over part of the town. Being upset with what happened, Mr. Floyd, is absolutely all American. Trying to occupy part of a city and turn it into a socialist enclave, not... So we got a lot going on in this country, and I don't want to blend them in. Chicago. I don't know what's happening in Chicago, but this is not about Mr. Floyd. Young kids are getting killed just outside their house. Somebody needs to do something about it. So my point is that this committee, and I appreciate this, Senator Cruz, is going to look at all of it. And all of it means what's going on in Chicago, and should the federal government help? How many kids have to die every weekend before enough is enough? As to the state police in Portland, I'm glad you're there. I hope it works out. But if you can't take care of it, we will. That's not being totalitarian. That's applying the law that exists in the United States today. It is a federal responsibility to protect federal property. You agree with that, Mr. Cuccinelli?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Cox, there are people out there who would kill you because of your race. Do you agree with that? White supremacist groups are alive and well in the United States.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Do you believe they're on the rise?
I believe that they've existed for some time. And as you
Well, I tell you, Mr. Ray, Director Ray said they're on the rise, and I believe that too. And I want you to bust their ass wherever you find them. Yes. We're not going to live in an America like this. So if you're a white supremacist, I hope you get a knock on your door soon if you're engaging in violence, and I hope you go to jail. So from my point of view, I don't want any American, black, white, anything in between, having to be afraid to live in their own country, not being able to let their kids go outside and play at night, and can't go downtown to one of the major cities.
South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, but Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin, the Senate's minority whip, said today's committee hearing was a distraction from the real threat, racist violence from white supremacy groups.
chairman started this meeting by saying we're talking about the leftist. Patrick Underwood was not killed by a leftist. He was killed by a member of an organization known as Boogaloo, a right-wing extremist organization. At least a gentleman, I shouldn't call him a gentleman, a person named Carrillo has been charged with that crime at this time. It ain't just leftist. They're extremists who are engaged in many places. Tomorrow is the anniversary, Mr. Chairman, the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting at the Walmart in El Paso, Texas. A 21-year-old white supremacist, and I won't repeat his name, with anti-immigrant views killed 23 people and injured 23 others. It is the worst racial extremism in American history against Hispanic Americans. An unclassified May 2017 FBI DHS joint intelligence bulletin found that, quote, white supremacist extremism poses a persistent threat of lethal violence. White supremacists were responsible for more homicides from 2000 to 2016 than any other domestic extremist group, right or left, white supremacists. FBI Director Wray told me last year in the hearing that the majority of domestic terrorism arrests involved white supremacists. And yet the Trump administration has made the inexplicable and I consider irresponsible decision to stop tracking white supremacist incidents as a separate category of domestic terrorism. Since May 2019, I've sent three letters to the Attorney General and FBI Director asking why DOJ and the FBI are doing this at a time when we should be combating the growth of white supremacist violence that targets religious minorities and communities of color. Today's hearing only reinforces my concern that the FBI and DOJ are not taking adequate measures to combat white supremacist violence and are minimizing the growing domestic terrorism threat. Instead of focusing on the real and significant violent threat of domestic terrorism motivated by white supremacy and far right-wing extremism, terrorists who have killed Americans, the Trump administration has repeatedly tried to vilify protesters and conflate social justice movements with anti-government extremism. Ms. Cox, you're very explicit. In fact, you say it twice within a matter of four sentences. In your statement, you say, our proactive focus on violent extremists is not on membership in particular groups or adherence to particular ideologies or belief, but on criminal activity and violence. You say that twice. Do you agree that violent white supremacists currently pose our most significant domestic terrorism threat?
I would definitely agree with Senator that we have a number of investigations that involve white supremacist group. In fact, before the civil unrest, the majority of the domestic terrorist investigations were white supremacy involved.
And as part of the Department of Justice, can you explain why your department has stopped tracking white supremacist incidents as a separate category of domestic terrorism?
I do not know anything about that, Senator.
Well, I hope you'll look into it. Mr. Cuccinelli, do you agree that white supremacist violent extremism is, what, quote, one of the most potent forces driving domestic terrorism?
I do, and that's why the Department of Homeland Security has upped its effort in that area. It is not correct to say we have ignored it.
Well, we've seen what you've done in Portland. What have you done about white supremacists?
Well, you cite one element of an increasing track of analysis and communication with local partners, which is DHS has the primary responsibility for, and communicating the information to state and local authorities that we get sometimes from others. And that, we've increased that effort, not reduced
Mr.
that.
Mr. Cuccinelli, good. That is what we expect in the ordinary and customary relationship between the federal government and state and local law enforcement. It is not what happened in Portland.
And that is Dick Durbin, who's the Senate whip and Democratic representative of Illinois, from Illinois, Senator. A Federal Protective Service officer, Patrick Underwood, 53, was shot and killed by a gunman during protests over the police killing of George Floyd while guarding the Ronald Dellums Federal Building in San Francisco, I believe. The killer, 32-year-old Stephen Carrillo, was associated with the Boogaloo movement, a loosely organized American far-right extremist movement.
And in local news, in New York, a tropical storm warning remains in effect for the five boroughs, but there are signs the storm's impact is starting to wane. Coastal flooding is now unlikely, winds are shifting rapidly, and the national NOAA tide gauges show water levels dropping. Strong winds are still lingering in the city, but they're expected to ease by 8 p.m. Rain totals also turned out to be much less than what was forecast. The city registered less than 1 inch of rain across the five boroughs, well short of the 2 to 4 inches that were originally forecast. A tree that fell in Queens killed one person. According to Mayor de Blasio, about 2,000 trees were downed in the city from the high winds. But the storm wasn't the mayor's only problem today. Gun violence is on the increase. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, a former NYPD captain, said many factors have led to the increase in gun violence, including the dismantling of the NYPD's anti-crime unit, the strained relationship of police in the community, and an issue with the number of handguns on the street. Today, the mayor blamed dislocation caused by the coronavirus pandemic.
We are dealing with a perfect storm. And every major city in America is dealing with their version of this because so much has been dislocated because of the coronavirus crisis. We have got to get all the pieces re-glued. This is why it's really important. We want school back. We want people back to work. We want to get our criminal justice system working again. We all need to work together to make that happen. But there's no question, again, that when you apply more and more officers to targeted areas, it has a real big impact. And as the commissioner said, there are very specific areas where we're seeing the biggest problems. And then as the court system comes back and more prosecutions and trials start to occur, I know that's going to have a profound impact. So we just have to stick with this strategy. We have done it before and overcome challenges. We will do it again.
And as Mayor de Blasio, data provided by the NYPD for July shows a 177% increase in shootings from the same month in 2019. That's a total of 244 shootings, up from 88 the year before. For the first 7 months of the year, that spike dipped slightly. There have been 772 reported shootings. The NYPD says a 72% increase from the 450 recorded between January and July of 2019. And finally, Thursday is the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan. The author of American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, who is the chief scientist and head of the Manhattan Project, the project that brought us the bomb, is Kai Bird. He says the bombing of Japan was unnecessary.
The conventional wisdom, most Americans today believe that the bomb was used to end the war and save, you know, they usually use the figure a million American lives or a million American casualties. And it's simply not true. The archives, the historical record is now very clear. For instance, General Eisenhower, the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe, when briefed at Potsdam by the Secretary of War that they were about to use this weapon on Japan, he expressed the opinion that it was unnecessary and an awful thing to do. 7 out of the 8 five-star generals or admirals in the American military at the time expressed the same opinion. They knew it was unnecessary. The problem is that most Americans don't understand that it wasn't a binary decision. Either we invade the Japanese home islands with great casualties or we use the atomic bomb. So it's a great tragedy in the history. And yet here we are 75 years after the bomb, and most Americans simply do not understand the history.
Where do we stand? Have we learned anything? And is this ignorance, this willful ignorance among Americans as to the truth of what they did in 1945, endangering our lives, our existence today?
We simply cannot squarely face the contentious history of our use of the atomic bomb. And this is actually quite dangerous. The possibility of one of these weapons going off accidentally or a dirty bomb being constructed by a terrorist group is very real. We're facing a real possibility of one of these weapons of mass destruction going off. We need to get back to a disarmament regime to take control of these weapons. We're now instead engaged in a $1.6 trillion modernization program to modernize our nuclear weapons. This was started under President Obama, not Trump. Weapons that are a danger to us precisely because they could be used accidentally or in a terrorist incident.
They're not even really weapons. That's a misnomer. They really can never actually be used.
They really aren't military weapons. As Oppenheimer said in October of 45, just 3 months after Hiroshima, these are weapons for aggressors, and they were used in the first instance on an enemy that was already defeated. Trump and the American military establishment is trying to, in this modernization program that we're undergoing at great expense, they're talking about modernizing our battlefield nuclear weapons, meaning tactical weapons that can be used to stop a column of tanks. But in that kind of battlefield scenario, once you use an atomic bomb, your opponent has a great incentive to retaliate, to stop it. Once you go down that road, it becomes a suicide pact. It's just madness.
Kai Bird is author of The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer. 3 days after Hiroshima, on August 9th, a second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. Both bombings killed over 200,000 people. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, August 4th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News from New York, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.